Hi, this is Mark Robideau from pilotworkshops.com. Welcome to the audio workshops. In the first program, Bob Martens hosts a roundtable discussion with John Krug and Bob Adelazzi to discuss IFR communications. John and Bob have had long and distinguished careers with air traffic control. Combined, they have over 50 years' experience in the ATC system, and both are also experienced pilots with advanced ratings. I think you'll enjoy the unique perspective they bring to this subject.
I think it can be safely said that the National Airspace System provides solid support to IFR flying, but I think we have to readily admit that the complexities and the variables associated with flying IFR, weather, the experience level of the participants, the aircraft mix, can bring the aircraft system to its knees when we find pilots that are operating from a venue of either ignorance or arrogance. So in this workshop, we are going to provide pilots with the opportunity to get inside the system. We want to look at the big picture with regard to air traffic control, as opposed to from the little picture of where we sit inside our cockpits. Perspective is very, very important. And today we have tremendous resources available to us. We're going to tap into these resources today by talking with Bob Adelazzi and John Krug to share their perspectives and their insights into the air traffic control system, specifically IFR flying. I think we need to say, and the system demands, that IFR pilots are held to a higher standard. And unless we maintain this higher standard, we're going to create problems out there. So let's take a look at how the system operates and what we can do as pilots to facilitate our use of this system and make it as efficient as humanly possible. Let's start with a typical IFR flight. We'll go through the process from pre-flight planning all the way to engine shutdown and discuss both towered and non-towered airport operations. John, let's look at pre-flight planning and some of the things that you'd recommend that a pilot can do in the pre-flight portion of flight to make our interface with air traffic control as efficient as possible.
Okay, Bob. Well, obviously, there's several obvious items that you want to start with. Weather, NOTAMs, aircraft performance, weight and balance, fuel requirements. We're not going to really get into that, but you just want to make sure that all the basics are covered, that you're not filing to an airport that's closed, that the approach NAVAID is out of service, that your aircraft performance is sufficient to get in and get out of the destination airport, and that you have enough fuel. And that's all basic piloting. One of the things that we always get questioned about is the very first thing is, how do I plan a route? What I wanted to talk about is how, as a controller, how you wind up issuing a clearance or how you wind up formulating a route. And really what it starts as, it's kind of a top-down system. The centers initially control all the airspace. They delegate airspace down to the approach controls, to the TRACONs, who then control the towers that are underneath their jurisdiction. So we think of it as a top-down system, and it's a very structured system. The closer you get to a major metropolitan area, the more structure that there's going to be, and the more structure that there needs to be because of the volume of traffic that's flying in and out of it. If you think of routes, we fly Victor Airways generally. And think of those really as like interstate highways. Interstate highways are designed to flow between cities, between geographical areas. Victor Airways are much the same. And interstates have on-ramps and off-ramps. You can't just jump on an interstate anywhere you want. You can't just jump off an interstate anywhere you want. And our routes are really much the same way. We have flows. They're arranged around arrivals and departures with exits and entry points. The on-ramps, we call them SIDs, and the off-ramps, we call them STARs. And once you get into flow, it just makes it so much easier. So understanding all that is kind of key to figuring out how you as an individual pilot will fit into the system. So in order to answer our question, what route do I file and why don't I get what I file? There's some resources out there that you can look at. One of them is the Green Book, the Airport Facility Directory. Has a lot of city pairs. They're generally grouped by approach controls. They don't necessarily list all the airports. Sometimes you have to do some interpolating to figure out where your particular arrival or departure is going to fit in that. Jepson also publishes in the front of their book something similar, not really the easiest to read. What we've discovered and what I use on an almost daily basis now is an internet service. It's called flightplan.com. Probably one of the best sites I've seen for that type of flight planning. You can put in pretty much any city pair, any airport pair, and it's going to list the route that people have filed before. After about 10 minutes, it'll show what the expected ATC route is. It'll come back and give you a pretty good idea of what you can expect. If you do choose to file with Flight Service, really all that they can do is confirm that the flight plan is accepted. They can't really give you much guidance. They don't have any information on the routes. So they'll accept just about anything that you give them.
We've solicited and received some terrific questions from pilots that use the website that raise some very, very interesting issues. The first of these is, what sort of things frustrate controllers with regard to pre-flight planning? What are some of the common mistakes you see from pilots that make life more complicated for you than it needs to be?
Well, Bob, some of the things that we see is obviously filing a wrong route or too complex a route. Very often you'll see people file to an initial fix. Pretty much everything that's done today is an airport clearance. You're cleared to the destination from on the ground to the destination airport. And I see people going through this, and even with some IFR students, it's a very common thing where they'll go through an exercise and find an intersection on an airway, and then the transition, and then the outer marker, and we just don't do business that way anymore. Everything is an airport clearance, so don't even waste your time trying to figure that out. And if you use the flight planning tools that I talked about, you will generally get the correct clearance. But let's talk about what happens when you do file a route to a distant destination that doesn't comply with the letters of agreement with the adjacent facilities. Remember, we talked about the top-down system, so whatever approach control or tower you're dealing with is going to have someone that they're getting their clearances from. The approach controller may be responsible for amending the flight plans. The tower controller may be. It depends upon the local equipment and local procedures. But some of the things that frustrate controllers is spending time looking up a route, whether they look it up in an automated system, they look it up in a loose leaf binder sometimes, and whatever they're going to have to do to look it up. The example I was discussing is you're on the ground at Bedford, and you're sitting there in your Baron, and you want to file to Springfield, Illinois. It's 800 miles away. You've got a GPS that will enable you to navigate that way. Controller on the ground has no idea where that airport is, what kind of airspace it interacts with, what fixes to start out with. So they're going to have to get out a chart and kind of eyeball it, take a look at what kind of route and how they can plug you into that on-ramp that's going to get you to the highway that's going to get you there. A lot of small airports, the ground controller is also the clearance delivery person, sharing those two responsibilities. If you're going to take a controller's time to fix a route like that, it's going to put you pretty far down on the priority list. So it's in your interest to try and learn the best possible way of filing. Generally, if you look at these routes that go out of an area, you can find a couple of common fixes that might be within 50 miles of the airport, 30 to 50 miles, something like that. Find a fix, file over that, and then go direct to the next fix. And when you do that, file VORs. Don't try to file RNAV, especially tower and route, low altitude things. It's just not going to work. Lat long fixes or RNAV fixes, such as a fixed radial distance, it's just not going to work.
John, we received a terrific question from a pilot in the New York City Class B airspace area that certainly is universal to people operating out of complex airspace. And it certainly involves what you've been talking about, the big picture versus the little picture. I'm sitting at a little non-towered airport in complex airspace. Why is it so difficult to get my clearance and to get it in a timely fashion? What do I need to know about the big picture that's going to help me operate in the little non-towered airport in busy airspace?
Well, the closer you get airports in proximity to each other and the closer the interaction is between those airports is going to impact getting a release. The clearance shouldn't be too much of a difficult issue. The issue is going to be more getting a release out of a congested area when there is such an interaction. For example, in the NOTAM book, the FAA publishes a chart that shows the interaction between Caldwell, Teterboro, and Morristown, probably three of the busiest satellite airports in the New York City metro area. And all three of those airports, the final approach courses overlap at the same altitudes, the Class D airspace all abuts. So anything that happens at one is going to affect another. The other thing that's going to be an impact there is the interaction between that tower and the approach control that overlies and controls the releases getting out of there. You may be sitting on the ground at one airport and you're filed over a VOR, you know, whatever direction you're going southbound out of Caldwell, and you're sitting there thinking, well, there's no one else around. Why can't I get a release? But there's a pilot on the ground at three or four or five of those other airports that are all within 5 miles, and they all want to go at the same place at the same time. So the tower controller and the approach controller have to negotiate something to get a release sequence going out of that.
All the more reason, as you said, to keep it simple as opposed
to keep it simple.
making a complicated request.
Right. And if you're, what you filed required a reroute, you're definitely going to the end of the list.
I think one thing that does complicate things is when you're dealing in an area like that was just described here, they will try to get the faster airplane out in front of the slower airplane, and just sometimes it's not available and sometimes it doesn't happen. I know what we deal with the Bedford Airport, we ask them to sequence their airplanes if they have multiple departures all of the same fix or the same route. Let's get the fastest one out in front, and then the rest of it usually works out quite well. But in something like this, when you really have maybe one way out and you need X amount of distance to accomplish this, that does slow it down. I was asked at one time, like, well, I'm in a ground here. Why can't I get out VFR? So you probably could, but why can't I get a release? I said, well, maybe if you can't do it that way, there's probably a good reason why they can't accept any more airplanes in the sky. They just don't want them. So
I think you bring up a good point, Bob, and that is, you know, a lot of times pilots in their impatience or their zeal to get airborne say, well, I'll just pick up my clearance airborne. And the complexity that adds to the system doesn't help you and really exacerbates the entire general area.
Right. And just to add to that, too, they may have filed, as John mentioned, a direct route. And he's got it all plugged into his GPS or his RNAV system, and he's all set to go. And he's actually maybe going the wrong way, because the PDR now takes him, instead of west, is going to take him south first and then west. And so now you're maybe in a position where you're flying the airplane, you're trying to pick us up, trying to stay VFR, and now we just gave you a route that's totally different than what you're expecting, and now it either requires a lot of writing down or punching into something, and who's flying the airplane?
So right. a lot of patience, both on behalf of the pilot and the air traffic controller. And you can see, and we often wonder how frustration mounts, how people, you know, you get, you know, yelled at by ATC or the pilot loses his temper. But once again, understanding that there is a big picture in which we are a very small part in, and just, I think, appreciating our role in that big structure helps us to achieve the desired result.
Right. Controllers don't like to delay airplanes. That's just not in their mindset. But every controller I've ever met always wants to move the airplane. So if you're sitting there, it's for a reason. It could be, as Bob said, you know, you need a reroute and you got to get back into the flow. It could be an in-trail. A lot of times in the summer, especially in the Northeast, there'll be in-trail restrictions to some of the island airports. You can take off VFR, but now you're going to fly circles for 30 minutes waiting for your slot time to come up. So where's the safest place to be from your point of view? On the ground, wishing you were in the air, or in the air, wishing you were back on the ground?
Very good. So I think that, you know, what we're saying here is obviously, you know, prior planning prevents poor performance. Planning to succeed, making sure that we've done our homework so that air traffic doesn't have to do that for us. And so if we do our planning, our preparation, and also keep it simple, we're probably going to get the best results. John, since we've done our pre-flight planning now, let's look at what it takes to pick up our clearance. What are some of the things we can do to make this as smooth and seamless as possible?
Well, Bob, obviously we're at a towered airport right now, so we're going to call clearance delivery or ground control, whoever the appropriate controller is. Initial call, very brief. You want the aircraft identification. You want to state your destination. And this is important because there's times that there may be multiple flight plans in the system. A lot of things can happen that could cause a duplication, and it's important that it's a double check, both you and the controller. The ATIS code, and most airports are going to want to know your location very briefly, usually just the name of the FBO or something like that. A lot of times they'll write that on the strip also so that the ground controller knows where you are. You want to be ready to copy as soon as you ask for it, because it's going to come right back at you, and it's going to come back in a standard format. One of the acronyms that is very handy is CRAFT, a CRAFT, clearance limit, route, altitude, frequency, and transponder. It's always going to come back in that same format. Another item that's really good is, again, flightplan.com. When you print out your flight plan from them, they have a great format, especially for inputting into GPSs. Shows all the turn points along the way. Each one of the intersections has a good format right on there for copying all the information that you need. SIDs will be routinely issued, whether you ask for it or not. They'll usually be issued. A lot of people will put in their remarks, no SIDs or stars. Most of the time, though, the SID's going to be routinely issued. However, a departure procedure will not be routinely issued. That's the pilot's responsibility to comply with it. What does the controller want to hear? The controller wants to hear you read back the numbers, the important numbers, the altitude assignment, the transponder code, the frequency. Those are the real important things. There's a kind of a movement afoot now. You'll read a whole lengthy clearance, and the pilot will just read back the transponder code. Got it. Well, that may be good enough for some people, but I want to hear at least the initial altitude and some of the other important pieces in there. You may also want to get in dialogue at that point when there's any gate hold or delays or any other information that the clearance delivery person can give you at that point. The one thing that you don't want to get into with clearance delivery or ground control is any kind of reroute or altitude requests. Most of the time they're at the bottom of the pipeline. They've gotten the clearance out of the computer, and they're not really able to do very much to accommodate a route or altitude request. The time to do that is much further down the line. After we've taken off, after we're at cruise altitude, probably talking to the en route center controller is the appropriate time to start doing that kind of stuff.
Bob, how about from your perspective, anything you've seen that might help out?
As John was talking about this, one thing that did come to mind is if the pilot that does file a direct route or, you know, GPS direct to a destination, and then we get what's called the PDR that prints out on the strip, and we're required to read that. As a courtesy to the pilot, the controller should say, I have a full route clearance advisory ready to write, so therefore he's not sitting there waiting, well, this is what I'll get, and he's expecting to be cleared as filed, and suddenly there's, you know, maybe four or five VORs, a couple of airways, and so forth, and he wasn't expecting that, so he'd be able to write this down. I think that would be much more beneficial.
Okay, and the PDR, of course, is the preferred departure.
It is, yes.
Okay. One of the things I know from a pilot perspective that makes me a little bit crazy is people trying to copy the clearance while they're doing something else. You know, we're all multitaskers, and you've probably seen an airplane taxiing as he's requesting his clearance. And there's a reason why, even if you have two pilots in the cockpit, that both of them should be focused on what you're doing. So if you're taxiing and trying to copy a clearance, well, you say, well, the first officer is doing it. Well, guess what? If you're taxiing the airplane, you're not listening to the clearance, so you're not backing each other up, and it is an excellent opportunity for errors and for creating problems. The other thing I think is so very, very important is that, you know, we all have sat there and tried to copy a clearance just as fast as we can from the guy that's speaking at the speed of sound. And sometimes, quite frankly, we need to have parts repeated. Clearing up confusion is meant to be done on the ground, not on departure climb out. Any thoughts from you guys on that?
I think you're right, because I think there's maybe a little hesitant on the part of some of the pilots not to ask a control to say again because of fear of, I told you, and, you know, stand by, and then they get pushed down the line a little bit. But in any type of an ATC clearance, if you don't understand it, you don't get any part of it, for some reason you have poor radio reception, you're in maybe in a bad part of the airport and every other word's coming out, you might definitely want to ask to be have the clearance read again.
Sure.
It's only going to find the problem later on in your flight, that if you somehow take a route that you think you're going straight ahead, but the route that you were issued but didn't hear is now a left turn at a certain spot or a different route, you have problems.
And quite frankly, you know, don't say you're ready for the clearance unless you're ready for the clearance.
Absolutely,
I mean,
yeah.
have the pencil ready, have the paper ready, have your clearance there in front of you, because you don't have to write the whole thing down if you already have it printed out there in front of you.
Right.
So being prepared and being ready, and obviously you can't do that if you're doing something else.
Right. Your head has to be in the game at that point. And that's the time to pay attention and the time to ask the questions.
You know, and there's one thing, like you mentioned about having a two-pilot airplane. There probably isn't anything bad if you're in a single-engine airplane or you know, a GA-type small piston airplane. If you have somebody that's got some pilot experience, to make them part of the crew with you, whether it's the clearance, taxiing, looking for other airplanes, as you know, take off in the terminal environment, start looking for traffic, make them part of the operation.
Resource management at
Absolutely.
Its best. Excellent. Okay, so now we're ready to depart. Clearance in hand, GPS is all loaded up. John, what comes next?
Well, we want to call ground control. Tell them we're ready to taxi. Want to mention, very important that we're IFR, because that can have a bearing on a lot of different things. The controller is going to look for a strip now instead of just taxiing out as a VFR airplane. I can recall several times where we had situations like that at satellite towers where an airplane would taxi out, not say he was IFR, ground control just says taxi runway 2, gets there, local control says clear for takeoff, and he was IFR. And the clearance is still sitting on the back shelf, and you know, now you've got an IFR airplane in the system without a release and in an inappropriate spot. So it's a good double check on the whole system to make sure that you mention that in your location on the airport. That's required now also. Make sure that we guard that all important runway. If you're at a strange airport, especially a larger airport, you might want to ask where you can do your run-up, some things like that to help fit in the flow, because where you do your run-up, if you're sequenced with other departures, or as Bob was talking about before, you may be two or three or four in line out there, but either a faster airplane gets to go first or whatever, you don't want to plug up the taxiway. So when in doubt, ask.
Another thing too is if they're running delays, or you're not sure if the controller is not sure if they can get you a release right away, and they have other aircraft that either can be released or VFRs, they may hold you at some place on the ramp, put you on an inactive taxiway, inactive runway, have you hold there, and then they can run the airport a little bit more efficiently than having you at the head of the line and suddenly there's no place else to put you, and then you're holding up the whole airport too. So.
And just one other pilot suggestion that I think makes all the difference in the world is making sure you have an airfield diagram out and ready. A picture, you know, speaks volumes. And with regard to confusion and staying ahead of the airplane, that picture will really help you get where you want to be without hitting some areas that you don't want to be involved in.
Absolutely. Okay, so the next thing is we call a tower. And what happens from the tower's point of view? The local controller, as ATC refers to it, and as a pilot, you would call it tower. It has some requirements before they can release an IFR aircraft. Sometimes they have to request a release from the controlling facility, whether it's a TRACON or even in some cases in a route center. Sometimes they can release on their own authorization. But regardless, they're going to have to comply with some in-trail requirements, possibly assign you a heading or an altitude. As a matter of fact, off a towered airport, you should always be assigned a heading if it's not part of the SID. It's one of those things that you want to ask for and make sure that you understand whether you're to fly runway heading, to turn to a specific heading, or you're cleared on course. So that's something that you want to make sure.
What are some of the things that make you crazy on takeoff, John? What are some of the things that pilots throw at you?
Well, not acknowledging a frequency change. When you check in with departure with too much information, and by that I mean if the tower controller says, you know, turn left heading 230, clear for takeoff, when you check in with departure control, the only thing the departure controller wants to hear is the altitude that you're leaving and the altitude that you're climbing to. Any other information should be exchanged by the controllers between each other on a landline or through their letters of agreement or their standard procedures. That's not to say that if the tower controller does tell you tell departure, you're on a heading or doing something, that if you've been instructed to do it, you definitely do it. But you shouldn't volunteer it, because all it's going to do is clog up the frequency.
One thing that I've noticed occasionally, and it doesn't happen a lot, and it doesn't particularly pertain to small aircraft, it's the not calling. They're still on the tower frequency, or they're lost in what we call frequency land, where they're on the wrong frequency for some reason. It mishappens off, you know, major airports. And we start going back. We make a couple of calls, no acknowledgement, then you go back to the tower. So you try so-and-so again, we're not talking to them. Well, in most environments, it's not a big deal. If you are at a smaller airport where you don't have a lot of vertical airspace to work with, and you just tied up 2,000 feet, but we're not sure if the aircraft is going to be climbing on its own. We don't know what's going to happen because, you know, now we're sort of in that what we call NORDO, no radio, what's going to happen to the airplane. So now we start sterilizing airspace in and around that, what's going on. It doesn't happen a lot, but when it does happen. So another thing, too, is if you're maybe a couple, 3 miles away from the airport and you still hear the tower and they haven't said contact departure, go back, say, do you want us on departure? Because maybe they forgot to. It happens.
So active listening is really a crucial point in the flight for making sure.
You've got to be part of the game.
And right, things are happening bang, bang on departure. Yeah.
Good rule of thumb is probably within a half mile to a mile off the end of the runway, if you're not switched over to departure and the tower controller hasn't said, for some reason, stay with me because I have traffic or something like that, that's a good time to ask.
Okay. I guess asking for a reroute on climbout wouldn't be a great deal.
No, that's definitely not one of the things you want to get involved with. The departure controller is busy. They're trying to get you climbed as quickly as possible to your requested altitude. You want to get up out of the low altitude turbulence or get on top, whatever. So wait a while before you start doing any negotiating.
Okay. John, one of the questions submitted to the website concern vectors after takeoff, and then ATC clears you on course. What are my actions? Do I fly directly to the next waypoint? Do I intercept the airway? What are my actions when cleared on course after a vector?
Well, Bob, one of the things that a controller is required to do any time a vector is issued, the purpose of the vector has to be issued also. So you should know what the vector is for. If the controller says it's a vector for an intersection, it's a vector for an airway, then you know. Big thing is, if in doubt, ask. You know, the AIM says that resume all navigation is issued after the completion of the vector. You need to know what the vector was for. If in doubt, ask.
John, how about the situation where I file GPS direct to a fixed or destination? My clearance is via an airway. And then on departure, I'm again cleared direct. Why the confusion? Why the runaround? Can you explain any of this to us?
Sure. Well, Bob, as we talked about earlier, there's routes, and the computer software will normally assign a route based upon the departure point and the destination or an en route fix. And a controller will normally start out with a lot of separation. We start out by putting an aircraft generally on a route, getting the aircraft established, and then you take a look at it, and you can chip away at it a little bit until you can issue the direct clearance. So even though you ultimately got what you filed, for a lot of reasons, the controller needs to start you off on a route that's going to have some structure to it. Because at the time that the clearance is issued, and by the time you take off, a lot of different things can happen. So, you know, you pretty much have to accept that you're probably going to get the shortcut, but you got to wait for the appropriate time.
And then there are sometimes, I can just address this one route. It's a route that you come out of the Boston North Satellite Airports, Lawrence, Bedford, Beverly, and it goes into Bradley's airspace for maybe about 8 miles. Then you make a left turn and go down to Norwich. Sometimes Providence, who will eventually get this aircraft, will call and say, send so-and-so direct Norwich. And we bypass the Bradley. It saves them a little bit of time and, you know, needless frequency change, quite honestly. So that's stuff that happens that you don't hear on the frequency. Happens with us internally, and it works out sometimes. So there are things that are going on all the time that, you know, either we coordinate it, they coordinate it, somebody calls up, volunteers a shortcut or something, and it works. So that's probably something that might happen too.
Right.
And it all goes back to the big picture perspective. Once again, in our little airplane, it certainly creates confusion, but we have to understand there's a bigger, broader airspace system out there, much of which we don't have a broad knowledge of. So we need to exercise patience and go with the flow.
It's a dynamic situation. Sometimes you can do it, sometimes you can't. But if you filed that direct Norwich, as Bob said, you're not going to get it. You're not going to get it. But as controllers, as I said before, we like to get rid of airplanes as quick as you can. So you gotta, just got to trust that the controller is going to do the best they can on that.
And I can speak from the facility I work at. Everybody's very aware of what it's costing to fly these airplanes, whether it's airlines or GA guys. It's just, if we can shorten somebody's day up, fine.